I'm okay.
No, I can do this.
So I can act like I'm okay.
Here's the, yeah, act.
Greetings, and welcome back to Zero Credits, the show where we talk about things. I'm Henry.
And I'm John.
And together we're Henry and John.
Oh.
I've done my duty.
Oh, how are you, Henry?
I'm alright. I'm sleepy, but not anymore, because I slept.
Nice. Most of us go through that cycle at least once a day.
You're right. How are you, John?
I'm good. My life is very full of nothing right now, because I graduated from college.
Gasp! Mm-hmm. That means you're a real person.
Finally, I'm a millennial.
Oh, are millennials just people who are out of college?
I read this essay that it basically supposed that when people say millennial, they mean like an underemployed someone with a bachelor's degree born between like 1984 and 2004.
So wait, what is an underemployed person with a master's degree born between those years?
Hypermillennial.
No. I don't want it.
Super duper millennial.
It doesn't get me any more powers or stats or bonuses to my combat initiative.
No. In fact, it lowers your initiative.
Oh, God. I'll never be able to fight a level one rat.
Nuh-uh.
Man.
But, yeah, that's... I don't think that's actually true, though the essay has... But there's been a lot of things going around about millennials lately that would make me real mad.
I saw an essay entitled... I'm a millennial and proud or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't read it because no one should have to justify the fact that they're proud of being who they are.
Yeah.
Or try to, like, justify the label that some other person puts on them.
I do think there's this storm surge of people fighting against the label of millennial. And I think in some ways it's warranted because, you know, there's that viral video that came out not too long ago that was essentially, I think the title of it was I'm a Millennial, like, Elders, I'm Sorry.
Okay.
And it was this this woman talking about how she saw a younger person who I guess she just assumed was young and entitled and millennially not hold the door open for an older person behind them, and then she went on this essentially this rant or screed about how millennials are, like, disrespectful and a disgrace and they don't contribute anything to society.
What do old people do?
Nothing.
Oh.
Considerably less.
I mean, if you're getting Social Security, aren't you draining resources from society?
But I think it had 41 million views the last time I looked at it. People are going crazy about it. She was on Fox News because, of course.
All I can say is... it's a door.
Yeah. It's just a door.
It opens. It closes. People can open or close it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can open it yourself.
And doors don't mean something greater in a societal context. They're just an object that you can use. And I think she was super misguided in making this rant about how millennials... She says that they don't contribute anything to society. Millennials give more to charity than any other documented generation.
Maybe what she means, what the old lady meant, was that millennials don't contribute anything to society because they're not standing around open everyone's doors.
Wait, do you think the person who made this video was old?
No, I'm confused.
Oh, she was young and she saw this happen.
Oh, she witnessed this.
She witnessed this without talking to or knowing either of these people. And then made this weird rant about how millennials are useless and disrespectful.
Was there, like, video evidence that this occurred?
No.
So we're taking this on eyewitness account?
An eyewitness account of someone just not holding a door for someone.
I don't trust eyewitness accounts.
Yeah.
Eyewitnesses get details wrong.
But even if that happened, even if I saw someone just not hold a door open for an older person, who cares? Who cares?
I mean,
it's a door!
I'll hold a door open, like, if I'm gonna go in the same door or something like that. If someone's coming out,
mm-hmm.
I'll open the door because it's just like, you'll get out of my way faster.
Yeah.
Now, if I'm going in a door and somebody's behind me,
mm-hmm.
the door's already open. I kind of pass it off. It's not like...
Yeah. I mean, I hold myself to very specific rules about holding doors open, because I used to think, you always do it, so I think that if you do a simple mental calculation, you're like, it's going to take this person longer than 3 seconds to get to the door behind me after I open it, don't hold it open.
Yeah.
Because then you're waiting for them.
Or
and it puts pressure on them.
Yeah, they
it makes you look weird.
A fast scuttle walk to the door. And then
that's not actually faster.
Nobody's happy in that situation.
Yeah, because you're not happy that they held the door open because you felt obligated to move faster. You create this unpleasant social contract. If someone behind you has to ascend at least 2 stairs to get to the door, don't hold it open.
Are we talking like 2 stairs and then there's a short walk to the door, or is it 2 stairs in the door?
2 stairs and a short walk.
Okay, yeah.
If they're upwards of 4 stairs behind you immediately into a door, you can hold the door open.
Okay.
Because to ascend those stairs, it'll take like 2 seconds.
But if they're 3 stairs behind and there's a short walk, you just slam the door closed.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's, I mean, come on.
I mean, if you can assume that this person is going to catch the door before it closes completely, you should probably hold it open for them. Because it's going to take them longer to open a door that's already been moving towards being closed because of inertia.
Yeah.
But never be the person like holds a door open for someone who's like 15 steps away.
You ever get caught like at a restaurant and like a big party's coming through and you open the door for them and then you're stuck standing there for like a minute?
Yep.
Because after that party gets through another party, then there are people coming in and people
coming
out.
And then you're
out.
Just a doorman.
And it's like, they all say thank you, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
But still,
this is a huge inconvenience for me.
It's like, my party's probably already seated and ordered drinks by now.
Yep.
And I'm holding the door here.
A definite one that I hate is in classrooms. If you're about to enter a classroom, you've been waiting for it to empty, and you see one person leave, and you're like, oh, you must have been like the last person to leave. I'll hold the door open for you. Then everyone starts leaving. And then if you let go of the door and it closes partially on someone, they'll like stop it and they look at you like you're an asshole. Dumb.
I like the people who are waiting to get into a class and the class is like letting out.
Yeah.
And so it's they wait for a break in the traffic to try to like squeeze in,
mm-hmm.
which just creates more like delay and stuff. It's like, just wait for everyone to get out.
It's not like class is going to start before everyone's gone. Like, I don't know why you're in such a rush.
I mean, odds are the professor's not even in the classroom.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, doors are dumb.
I have a rule about doors. I don't hold the door open for women anymore. Because it's 2016 and they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
I open the door for men because, I mean, we don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Old people, I flip off, but I also still open the door.
Yeah.
Kids, I kick away from the door
mm-hmm.
because they shouldn't be going to
they
where
I'm going.
They shouldn't
be in buildings.
Kids shouldn't be in buildings.
They shouldn't be confined.
The homeless, I will give them a door.
Yeah.
And then I will open it for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will take the door with me.
In a symbolic gesture, you will open the door for them.
Yeah, it's like I would open the door if we were going to the same place.
If you could be in a place with a door, I'd open it for you. But you can't because you're homeless and you're forbidden.
Stray dogs I let into buildings.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's hot out there. You, mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want that dog to get too hot.
Yeah. Birds I will redirect to a window, and then I will open that window.
Birds don't go indoors.
No,
they
don't.
If they do, it's chaos.
If the bird goes into to a door, it might as well be a dog.
Here's an actual real-life thing.
What's
Have
up?
You ever noticed that if a bird flies in through a door, it's always chaos, the bird's confused, it doesn't know what's going on. If a bird comes in through a window, it just, like, perches on something, then leaves?
Yeah.
I don't think birds are meant for doors.
Birds...
I think doors freak them out.
Well, it's like a larger window, and then it also... You can't see through it. You can see through a window.
I think it's also the fact that it closes automatically. The bird's like, haha, window. What? No! And then they just freak out.
This is my life now.
Yep.
I'm going to peck everyone here to death.
Until I die, because there's no food here.
That's weird, because sometimes I'll be like in a strange airport. When I say strange, I just mean a different airport
yes.
from the one that I usually go to. And I'll just be sitting there, and I look up, and there are birds in the rafters. And mm-hmm. I'm just like, they must eat out of the garbage, or like, they eat the popcorn that people leave, because everyone at the airport has popcorn.
Yeah.
But somehow there's a small ecosystem of birds existing in this wing of an airport.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel bad, because it's like, get out of here, birds.
Get out of here.
I can't hold the door open for you.
You can't, only a window. You know, you ever think about the strange little social contracty things where... expected to uphold in every basically every facet of our lives.
How many exchanges is it after someone sneezes now?
A lot.
There's the sneeze. Then a stranger, another person will say, like, bless you, to your health, salute, you know, a thing, acknowledging the sneeze.
Yeah.
And then, what happens?
The person says thank you.
And now I have to say you're welcome.
If, the thing is, that is the most extend, if you wanted to, it could be like, sneeze, bless you, thank you, you're welcome. It's really no problem. Don't worry about it. It could get as long as...
What are you doing for lunch?
Yeah.
I have to eat lunch with you now? What is this?
It could become as long of an exchange as you really wanted it to be. But I have a rule, like all things.
Okay.
If someone sneezes once, I say bless you. If someone sneezes twice, I say Gesundheit. If someone sneezes three times, I say stop it. And if they sneeze again, I don't say anything.
See, here's the thing. Like, I also have a rule.
Mm-hmm.
You get one, like, bless you.
Yeah.
If you sneeze multiple times, if I know you're a multiple sneezer, I will stretch out that bless you the length of sneezes. Like, I have a friend who, he's a multiple sneezer. I always talk to him over Skype while I'm playing, like, a video game or something. He starts sneezing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll go, bless you.
Okay.
Usually four or five around there. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, one time he asked, what are you doing? I'm like, well, everybody only gets one.
Mm-hmm.
And you sneeze a lot.
Yeah.
So I have to, like, dole out your one.
I like to imagine that you're going, bless you, as he's sneezing throughout.
I sing it like in a, it's a Catholic mass.
Bless you, Domine. Is it okay for me, an atheist, to say bless you? Because I don't believe that blessing is a thing.
I mean... See, here's what... The thing about, like...
But also, blessing has two different meanings,
yeah,
depending on your...
You're just well-wishing, basically.
Yeah.
You're wishing well for them.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you could take a contrarian status with the wishing part, but you're...
Yeah.
It's all figures of speech, really. We're not... Mm-hmm. Because even, like, if you go with, like, through pure Christianity, the congregation can't bless, only mm-hmm. the...
Yeah.
You know, the father, the padre, the reverend can.
Mm-hmm.
Other countries, like this is salud in Spain, which just means, like, which literally just means health.
Yeah.
They're saying be healthy or like...
Healthy, yeah.
And I think Gesundheit is the same. I think that's also sort of more of
I think it's like a health thing.
A health-related thing. It's just something to acknowledge that you sneezed.
Yeah.
And to scare the soul that's leaking out of your nostrils back in.
Oh, I see. There we go. I say this because I said bless you once to a militaristic atheist friend of mine.
Wait, they had, like, guns? They were
no.
Militaristic?
No, it's they were militarily atheistic. Like
a militant?
Militantly. There we go. No.
They were a soldier?
She did own a shotgun, which, that's no big deal. But I said bless you, and she was very upset. And she was like, I don't believe in blessings. You can't bless me. I'm like... Get off of your high horse. Who cares?
This
I'm just saying a thing.
This is a common social contract thing that we have to adhere to.
Yeah.
Or else the social police will carry us away to social prison.
Have you ever broken one of these social contracts, like, either without realizing it or intentionally, and you just see the weird fallout from it?
I'm imagining someone sneezing, and then you say, like, fuck you! fuck you for sneezing!
Yeah.
But, no, there is, in my sociology class, we had to break a small social norm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nothing that would get us arrested, nothing too deviant.
Yeah.
But we had to perform a deviance, and a common one is face the wrong way in an elevator.
Mm-hmm.
Just, it's like, you entered the elevator last,
mm-hmm.
and then you turn your back on the door and just look at everybody.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. People freak out, they're like, you know, they get panicked. I'm doing a reaction thing that our listeners can't see, but it's like... It's like a deer in headlight scenario.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of freeze, look around like, oh god, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And then you just, you know, it dings. You take a step back off the elevator.
I like that as you take a step back, you're still looking at them.
And then you start snap gunning.
Yep. But yeah, that's... I broke one of those intentionally to be funny. It was not funny.
Mm.
So my significant other at the time said... I love you. Not for a first time, maybe a hundredth time.
Oh, no.
And I just said, okay, to be funny.
Yeah.
Oof, not funny.
You know who doesn't really take social contract breaking norm jokes as well.
Oh.
Significant others.
Yeah. I thought it was really funny at the time. Was not.
Oh my gosh. That reminds me. The first time my current girlfriend said the love word, she was like down and out due to illness.
Yeah.
And I was just like, okay. And was like holding her to make her feel better. And she said like something like, I think I'm falling in love with you. This was 2 weeks in.
Oh, okay.
And I was
not that bad.
So I patted her head.
Yep.
And said nothing.
Ooh.
No fallout.
Yeah.
Later she's like, did I say that I was, I was like, yeah, you said that. She's like, oh god.
Yep.
She was like really embarrassed because it was way too early into like the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I was just like,
I'm really bad with, the thing is, I feel like it always comes up very soon for me. I feel like if we hang out like 3 times that doesn't get said, that's way too long.
Really?
But like, because I think, like, what she said, that's pretty serious.
Yeah.
But just the 3 words, you know.
The I love you?
Yeah. Words mean, those words mean a lot of things. Oh. And it means a spectrum of things. And it's not that serious. But what she said, man, sever.
We need, no, I didn't.
I'm kidding. I'm still with her. I know this person. And
5 years
great.
Strong. She listens to the podcast.
Yeah. And
why did I bring this up?
She's great.
Okay. Oh, gosh. English language needs a lot more words for love, you know, because other languages, they break up the love to like platonic love or like love as a, you know, fraternal.
Yeah.
Brother, you know, like Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love or something like that. We need different words for it. You can love food, you can love animals, but it's not like, that's not the same
kind of
love.
It's not the same
way.
It's, you know, just a way of, it's just communicating different levels of appreciation.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of the movie, like, I think it's Superbad.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
At the end of the movie, like, in a very, like, fraternal way, two, like, teenagers tell each other that they love each other.
Yeah.
And they make a point to be like, it's not weird. It's true. It's just appreciation.
No homo.
Hashtag.
I hate that.
Me too. It's the worst. But no, English is very bad at, like, communicating appreciation for people or things. We have very few words for it.
I mean, the English language really evolved to be, like, the earliest instances where here's food, there's enemy.
Yep.
That's it.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's all Germanic and Latin. And Latin's a beautiful language, but we seem to have, It's a partial romance language. Not Latin. Latin is the...
Yeah.
But English is a partial romance, partial Germanic language.
English is a Germanic language with romantic items that they've stolen from the houses of others.
Yeah.
But, and then that way it's the greatest language because it contains all languages.
Do you think English grew into a thing that's really hard to appreciate... Not appreciate, to communicate appreciation with because... We have semi-puritanical roots in the English language?
Probably. I mean, the language and the culture go hand in hand. And once you stop, once you start, what is the word I'm looking for?
Like, break it down, dictionary definition.
Not restricting? Well, how would you describe Puritans?
Once you start wearing buckles on your hats.
What's the word?
Really long socks.
What's the word for, like, forcing people to not do something? Is it oppression?
You can oppress people, but oppression's more general.
Repress.
Okay. There you go.
Once you start repressing the language, or like repressing certain emotions and stuff like that, the language that you would use to describe those sort of things dies off. Because you stop using it. So, like, sexually repression, stuff like that, that's kind of like in the South, or at least, like, in certain areas of the South, you can't really talk about sex in mixed company because everybody gets a little nervous.
Yeah, everyone gets super uncomfortable.
And that's just that certainly comes from puritanical roots and also from like the Southern polite thing that has propagated forever.
I mean, I guess if you exist within a system which tells you not to express certain things, you're not going to make your language capable of expressing those things.
Yeah.
Is that why Italian has so many great ways to communicate appreciation for things, but we don't?
Probably.
Because they were, I mean, they were Catholic.
They weren't, I mean, but they weren't really repressed in the same manner.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, Italians are kind of like about celebrating life and expressing your appreciation for it.
Yeah. Also, the French are really good at that, too.
A lot of Europe does that, except for, of course, the English.
Where we came from.
You know, oh gosh. But as you go to Ireland, I think it gets a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
It might just be like the history that English carries with it naturally made it sort of like a repressed language where certain avenues of expression were cut off and sort of dried out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of why we lean on the Romantic languages to, like, kind of fill those gaps today.
Yeah, I mean, where our German failed, we took things... I mean, so many of our words about, like, appreciation and sexuality and stuff do come from Romance languages. Like, we stole them, we changed them around a little bit.
Yeah.
But, I don't know.
Language is weird.
Language is super weird. Let's all speak Esperanto.
Isn't that made-up language that's supposed to be, like... Is it non-offensive or something like that?
No... I don't think so.
It's just supposed to be like everyone can learn it easy.
Yeah, it's supposed to be the easiest language to learn.
I'm pretty sure it's dead already.
There are quite a few Esperanto speakers.
Well, it looks funny.
It does. I was thinking about learning it. I forget this is me zero crediting it up, but there is a language that's the easiest language in the world to learn, and it has only a couple hundred words.
Oh.
And everything is just a compound of words.
Okay.
Like, you know, if you want to say airplane, you're like, flying tube machine.
Okay.
Yeah.
So kind of like the old kenning, which was a poetic device of the old English writers, where they kind of put two words together to make a new word.
Eyeballs.
That one. Also, like, if you were going to refer to the ocean, you would call it a whale road.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Because it's the road that whales traveled by.
I love that.
Yeah. Beowulf is actually a kenning.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Beo meant bee.
Mm-hmm.
Wolf meant thief.
Oh.
Because there were wolves and there were bears.
Oh, I see.
But there was no word for bear.
Mm-hmm.
But a bear was a bee thief, because wolves would steal livestock, bears would steal honey.
Oh!
So Beowulf is just a bear.
Oh, I didn't know.
And that, I mean...
Is everyone a bear in that story?
No, just Beowulf.
Oh, okay.
Well, if you notice, like, Beowulf has a sword.
Mm-hmm.
He's not really successful with it.
Yeah.
He tears off arms, much like a bear would.
Is he just a bear?
He might be.
That's crazy.
But he's very bear-like, if nothing else.
Is Grendel a bear?
Grendel? No one knows what Grendel is, or Grendel's mother.
I really like the idea that they're just these people who are really drunk and invite a full-on bear into their meat hall. Like, oh, he's a champion, just like knocking dishes around.
That reminds me of a D&D story I read.
Oh?
Where it was a person rolled out a bear rogue.
Mm-hmm.
Put, like, a lot of points in bluff and disguise, and was just a bear who was really good at bluffing disguising. Couldn't speak common, but, like, could, like, through bluff and growling, make people think that he was speaking common.
That's amazing.
According to later in the story, someone got drunk enough to, like, look and like, wait a second. And the bear finally rolled low on the disguise check.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy freaked out and was like, wait, there's a bear!
This is actually just a bear!
And everyone else in the room was like, you're drunk, get him out of here! That is Lord Barrington!
That's amazing.
Yes.
I would read that.
I love reading about weird D&D stories, way more than I would actually probably enjoy playing D&D.
I think you'd really enjoy it if it was... Okay, here's a screed I can go on until we get to the break, because I can talk about this for as long as possible.
John,
ah,
what are we doing?
What?
We haven't said those
words. Oh, what are we doing?
Yeah, what are we doing?
What we're doing right now is talking about cooperative narrative experiences.
Cooperative narrative experiences!
Yeah, like Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, Dungeons & Dragons, that's a game.
It is, and I haven't played a ton of these games, but I really appreciate them.
They're good, they're good.
I think that when done right, and they're very... very rarely done right.
Oh, tisk tisk.
I think they're one of the, like, strongest group experiences you can have. Like, back when I played Dungeons & Dragons, Call of Cthulhu, all these, like, dice-based character sheet nerdy experiences, you can be, like, really engaged for, like, 10 hours and create surprisingly cohesive narrative content.
I mean, it's pretty awesome when you have, like, no distractions.
Mm-hmm.
It's just you, the table... and you guys are working literally together mm-hmm. to create this story.
I mean, have you ever read any of the... I think there's Steve Jackson Choose Your Own Adventure books?
No.
They're Choose Your Own Adventure books with statistics. Like, you create a character and has this money in this, this many in that.
Oh, so it's kind of like a single-player D&D thing?
Yeah, actually. Okay. And in fact, there are a few of them. They created these really attractive Android apps that are free. Some of them.
Free?
Yeah.
I like free.
Do you have Amazon Prime?
I do.
Amazon Underground is the service that lets you get paid apps for free with all of the content.
Did you hear that? If you have Amazon Prime, you can go to Amazon Underground and get free apps.
That's true. We're not actually sponsored by them, though.
Oh, damn it.
Get on it, Amazon.
Come on. We're good for it.
But no, it's... you're essentially doing the same thing when you have a group, is you're just telling a story with certain mechanics. It's a constrained way of telling a story. It's less of a game and more of a like a group writing exercise in a way.
I mean, D&D is basically just group storytelling.
Yeah, it is.
It's got mechanics and rules, and you do level up, and there is a game part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're working together to weave a narrative of an epic quest, or several epic quests. Mm-hmm. I can't... pain, if you will.
And it's so great the kinds of stories you can tell with these things. And I feel like they're definitely less marginalized now than they have been in the past.
Yeah, it seems, you know, pop culture sort of picking up on it. Things like The Guild, not really, that's World of Warcraft. But things like Critical Role,
mm-hmm.
the D&D episodes of Community,
mm-hmm.
even like Harmon Quest, stuff like this.
There's a number of tabletop YouTube channels with like hundreds of thousands of views per video, where people just play board games and tabletop games.
It's even a category on Twitch now.
Yeah, and I think it's definitely has more of a place now than it did, but it has been reviled for quite some time.
Oh yeah,
very unjustly so, and I think that it has. And this is my major problem with it, is so hard to find a good group of people to weave these narratives with, because since it's been reviled, it tends to attract a certain crowd that is not good at creating stories. It attracts a crowd of people who really just have nothing better to do, and don't have, like, greater interests or greater ideas about narrative. And that's not me shitting on these people, I'm just saying they're not well-versed in, like, creating a compelling narrative. But when you have those people together, it's so good.
Yeah.
And I'm actually probably going to do one of those things over the summer.
You keep messaging me about it, so...
because I'm super excited.
I can't tell if you're excited or drunk.
I haven't been drunk in a few days.
Okay.
Not since graduate.
That was Friday.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
All right.
But no, just super excited about it. Like, the idea of having these experiences play out in my, like, mid-20s, when I know so much more about narrative, and I've accumulated this group of friends who's has pretty good taste in general.
Okay.
So it's pretty exciting.
Well, I mean, one thing about these cooperative narrative experiences is that I read, like, highlights, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But these things are hours and hours in the making. Mm-hmm. You need a lot of free time.
Yeah, for sure.
And you know what you don't have the longer you live?
A lot of free time.
Until you retire.
Yep.
And then you have all of it.
You know what the best way to do it is?
Retire now.
Nope.
Oh, how?
You eschew things like D&D, which have tons of, like, mechanical complexity. You break down the mechanical complexity into something that's very simple, and you maintain the storytelling aspect that, well, having, like, minimal math, like very simple character sheets. Like a thing that I really like is there's a, and I've written stuff about this because I'm a huge nerd, but there's this guy named Greg Stolze, and I adore his work. He made this thing called the One Roll Engine.
Okay.
It is a system in which everyone rolls a number of dice once, like everyone does it, and that is an entire encounter, or at least an entire turn of an encounter. There's no like multiple settings for like initiative or like damage or stuff like that. Everyone just rolls once, and it's over.
So that number just is everything.
Yeah, because it's, you roll a number of d10s, and there's height, which is how high you get, and width, which is how many matches you get. And that's all you care about, that's all you write down. And width is just how fast it happens, and height is how well it happens.
Okay.
And you just, and the person running it just weaves a narrative. It's like, if that person went before that person, I describe that as happening.
Wow.
It's really fast. Okay. Really simple.
But I want to roll 20 die.
You can roll 10.
No, I want to roll a d20.
You can't.
Can I roll 20 d1s?
Yes. A d1 is an impossible object.
It's just a piece of paper.
Actually, it would just be like an orb with 1 written on it.
It's a ball.
Yeah, not an orb. What? What's the difference between an orb and a sphere and a ball?
They're probably all the same.
Orbs.
Orb is just a very fancy way of saying a ball or a...
Orb. Orb is a great word.
Orb.
Orb.
It makes me think of like a magical thing that like has lightning in it.
You know, there was a game released.
Oh no.
A few years ago.
Oh gosh.
It had a great title.
What was it?
It was a puzzle game.
Orbs of the Puzzles.
It was called Wizorb.
Wizorb.
You were a wizard with an orb. Wizorb.
I don't think it gets any more simpler than that.
It doesn't. You know,
more
else,
simpler.
You know what else doesn't get much simpler?
What?
Ads.
Oh, like the ones we need to run right now?
Yeah.
Let's run some ads. Oh man, boy howdy, am I ready for some breakfast treats?
Really?
Yes. Oh, are you hungry there, John?
Oh, you know it, every day.
It's breakfast time in the morning.
It is. What are we here for?
I'm gonna give you some nice breakfast treats.
What is it?
Here it is, let me get it, let me get the box out.
Mm-hmm.
Here it is. Everyone knows what it is, cause it's good. It's a bowl of fish soup.
A bowl of fish soup? How did you know?
I know you like the proteins and the omega-3 fatty acids and...
I can't eat fish.
Don't worry, that's not a real fish.
Oh, what is it?
It's Pop-Tarts.
Pop-Tart fish cereal bowl?
What? No, it's fish soup. I cut a Pop-Tart in the shape of a fish.
Oh.
Injected it with just a whole mess of omega-3 fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
And put it in a bowl of water.
I thought this was fish blood, but instead it's just strawberry filling.
You're right. It only works with strawberry Pop-Tarts.
Why?
That's just how the product is made.
I'm so glad you showed this to me.
How does it taste?
Terrible.
You gonna eat it?
Uh-huh.
Good.
I'm hungry.
When you're hungry and it's breakfast time and you need some fish soup, it's hungry breakfast time and you need some fish soup. Yeah.
Pop-Tarts.
What? No. The what? Product was fish soup.
Oh, fish soup.
You jerk.
I thought it was Pop-Tarts.
Why don't you appreciate me? I gave you breakfast.
Pop-Tarts.
I gave you breakfast and this is how you repay me.
You're getting paid for this.
I'm getting paid, but you don't like it.
You're getting paid by the fish soup company.
But you just keep saying Pop-Tarts, and there's more to it than just Pop-Tarts.
Whoa.
I'm going back to sleep for the rest of the day.
Okay.
I'm depressed, and I wanna go to sleep for the day. I'm gonna go cry myself to sleep for the day.
Fish soup. Greetings, and welcome back from the ad.
Hi.
Nothing will be the same.
Everything's different now.
Have you ever read The Archaic Torso of Apollo?
Is that a book?
No, it's a poem by Rainier Maria Wilke. Maria Rilke? What's his name?
Rilke?
Rilke.
R-I-L-K-E? Rilke?
Yeah.
I've never read it, no.
It's really good. You should read it.
He was young when he died.
Hey.
Like 23.
He was.
And he's a very famous poet now.
He's one of my favorites.
He was a really good one.
Am I misremembering his name? Rainier Maria Rilke.
Dude, I just know Rilke.
Rilke.
I don't know his...
Rilke. No, he's great. Okay, Corso Apollo.
Why are you bringing this poem up?
Because I said something about change, and the last line of that poem is, "You must change your life."
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really affecting.
You must change your life.
The idea that someone is looking at this piece of art and reflecting on themselves without realizing it until you get to the end of the poem and you realize he's been talking about this piece of art, but he's been reflecting inward, and then what it's saying to him is that he must change his life.
And in that way, like, that's the effect that art should have on people.
Mm-hmm.
We should see things and observe them and reflect on them so much that it becomes impossible to live the same life we've been living.
Mm-hmm.
At least, I think that's what he's trying to
say. I agree 100%. And, you know what the great part about art is?
What?
You see it with your eyes.
But you experience it with your body.
What did you watch?
Oh.
I was trying to do a segue.
I was interrupting.
It's okay.
So, John.
Yeah?
What did you watch?
I have to start? Okay.
Well, yeah, you're the only one who watched something.
I read a book.
A books?
A whole book.
What? Oh.
Turns out when you graduate from college, you can read a whole book in one day. Because, like, when you start reading a book sometimes, you're like, I need to laser focus on this because something's going to happen to take my attention away because I have obligations. So I'll stop when something comes up. And then when nothing comes up, you read a whole book in one day.
Wow. Was it a good book?
Yeah, it was pretty good.
Oh,
was it? It was Silver Screen Fiend by Patton Oswalt.
Oh, Silver Screen Fiend by Patton Oswalt.
Yeah, you know Patton Oswalt.
Yeah, he's a comedian.
He's very good. Book is very good.
What's it about?
It's about his period of a rather unhealthy obsession he had with film, stretching from, I think, 1995 to 1999, I think, something like that.
Okay.
He talks about how he wanted to be a director rather than a comedian.
Yeah.
So he had this really unhealthy love affair with cataloging, watching every, like, important movie he could, which turned into every movie he could.
Wow.
And it's very dishy about mid to late 90s alternative comedy scene, which I really appreciate because that's my shit. And I think it's a barely disguised, like, really unflattering depiction of Matthew Perry from Friends.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Matthew Perry.
Matthew Perry can be kind of a dick, apparently.
Well, he was on coke for a long time.
Yeah.
He was a coke fiend.
It's either that or the guy who played Ross.
David Schwimmer?
Yeah.
I've heard good things about him.
Well, it's one of the two. Like
probably
I said.
Probably Perry. Perry was on coke.
Yeah.
You can tell when he quit, because on the show Friends, suddenly he's lost, like, all of his weight.
Nice.
Yeah, it's just like, man, rehab hit him hard.
But, certainly it's really... What I really like about the book is it starts out and it is a smorgasbord for, like, cinephile trivia.
Okay.
There's so much stuff being thrown at you, like, Eyes Without a Face is thrown at you, like, Franju's, like, film noir horror movie, and a whole bunch of really obscure things that make you, like, gobble up, and you're like, meh, this book is for me, because I know, like, stupid, trivial bullshit about movies.
So it's nonfiction.
It's nonfiction.
Okay.
It's an autobiography.
Oh.
It's autobiographical.
But it's not his entire life, just this one
just
period.
Just a portion. Just okay. A portion of his life. Much like Zombie Spaceship Wasteland is only about a portion of his life.
Wait, is that also by Patton Oswalt?
Yeah, that was his first book.
So he's just sort of like compartmentalizing his life into books.
Pretty much.
And that way he will live forever.
Yep. Much like William
Defoe.
Faulkner. No.
That's Willem, never mind.
Willem Faulkner. And... It's almost a great bait and switch because it's written in this very, like, baiting way with all of this information about, like, esoteric film shit, which I dug. And then eventually the message of the book becomes pretty clear about halfway through that it's not good to exercise this knowledge that you have all the time because you become, like a babbling acolyte about things people do not care about.
Yeah.
It ended on a really weird place for me. The book made me feel very self-conscious. Because I tend to be a person who does have knowledge about movies or books that not necessarily everyone does, you know, because I'm a voracious consumer of things, but he lands on a point of like, maybe you don't share that all the time. Maybe it's not for everyone. Maybe it's something you can use to connect with people, but you shouldn't use it as a point of pride, and you shouldn't like deride people for not having the information. You shouldn't hate people for not having the vocabulary to appreciate things in quite the same way that you have that vocabulary.
I can get behind that, because like there's this weird thing in our culture now that's like, wait, you haven't seen the latest doodad? What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
And I've kind of developed a mantra that's like, everyone has their own experiences. And so while they may not have experienced the latest Civil War American captains, maybe they've experienced something else recently that's different from your perspective.
And I think definitely it's something that I'm guilty of is when someone has not had the same experiences as me, my snap judgment is, oh, they can't appreciate things the way I do. Maybe they've had experiences that let them appreciate things more than I can.
Yeah, there's not one way to appreciate things.
And he uses anecdotal evidence of himself, and he says the fastest way to drive someone away is like, oh, you've seen Sunset Boulevard, but you haven't seen Ace in the Hole? You can't possibly love film the way I do. Ugh. And it's this crazy bias you have towards yourself and your experiences because you think that the way that you consume is right.
I think it also has to reflect on, like, the culture that you surround yourself by. Like, was he in L.A. during this time period?
It starts in his time in Virginia, and then he moves out to L.A.
Because, like, L.A. is very much a lot of elitism, a lot of... we put up barriers to justify our social status sort of thing. It's like, oh, you can't possibly understand what it's like to watch one of these movies because you haven't been a director in a film or something like that.
And I mean, part of what he describes in the book is his transformation from being this very wacky, obviously fake kind of comic in his early days in Virginia. Then when he moved... and North Carolina, too. Okay. And he started to notice these people in the alternative comedy scenes referencing books and movies and literature that he had enjoyed previously, and he formed a bond with these people. And then we started going and seeing movies at places like, you know, the New Beverly, for example, and the Alhambra. He met more and more people who were what he called sprocket fiends. Like, these people who attach to films in really, like, direct, affecting ways. And when you surround yourselves with those people and you become a part of their culture, you start to feel entitled to a kind of knowledge that only those people have, and you judge everyone else based on it.
Okay.
And it's definitely something I do, maybe to a lesser degree, but it's something I struggle with for a while, is judging people based on their esoteric vocabulary of things.
I mean, look, vocabularies, unless you live and breathe it, unless you use it every day, it fades away.
Yeah.
Like, I can't remember the parts of a sentence, nor should I.
Yeah.
Because how often does that come up in everyday conversation?
I mean, I will catch myself sometimes feeling somewhat ashamed that I can't remember, like, who directed Ghostbusters 2.
That wasn't Dan Aykroyd?
It was, who was it? Steven Spielberg? No. But no, like, if I can't remember actors or directors or authors of books... or characters, I feel bad.
I mean, the thing about that is, at least for movies, there's a whole database for that now.
Yeah.
Which could lead to memory loss, because why remember it if there's a reference for it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, authors and books, I mean, you can Google it, but you should remember that. I mean,
come on. No.
Who wrote Beowulf?
Bee Thief. Bee Thief wrote Beowulf.
You're right, it was Bee Thief McJones.
It was. But no, it's... I know, it's definitely something that I think we both could describe ourselves as almost professional-level consumers.
I mean, I'm pretty much a consumer of all things.
Like, we just consume things, and we consume them pretty voraciously. And it's something you need to guard against, becoming this, like, babbling, mechanical judgment machine.
I never really developed the vocabulary to talk about the things that I enjoyed on, like, a critique level. I am not... a critic, or at least I'm not a critical critic, who can point out, like, yeah, the second... A good example of this is like in movies where they talk about first act, second act, third act.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, man, that movie had third act problems or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Which they just mean to say the ending wasn't good.
Yeah.
And I can say that in a different way without the nomenclature or the jargon.
Mm-hmm.
And I can pinpoint where I would do it better, but I just don't use the vocabulary that these people in the know have developed. Because I just see it as a weird sort of form of, like, it's one of the barriers that they set up. Where it's like, you have to know what, like, oh, a deep cut means. That means, like, that's a they're referencing something that happened years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't want to have, like, a little legend to the conversation I'm having.
I mean, to a certain point in my life, I've begun to... In things I surround myself with, I despise lingo. I think lingo is pointless because you can communicate it more easily. But I do find myself saying things like, you know, if we're talking about movies, I'm like, oh, well, if you compare it to Malinoche, Gus Van Zandt's first work. And I say all these things essentially to stroke my own ego without contributing anything, because I could have said what I meant in, like, a sentence fragment.
Yeah.
Instead of going on for, like, a paragraph about how I felt about all these works that I saw and maybe you didn't see.
I mean, the thing that I do when someone brings up, like, a director's previous work or something like that is, like, I ask the question, well, what in this film makes you think of that?
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't answer that, or, like, they struggle to answer that, or they don't answer that question completely, I know that they're just trying to bring up the fact that they've watched more movies in this director's sort of line. And they just wanted to bring it up.
It's just consumer name dropping.
Pretty much.
You're just saying, like, this is a thing I've experienced, but you don't... And maybe even then, if you rely on that too much, you lose that vocabulary we're talking about. You lose the ability to say, you know, I enjoyed this because of this. Not, I enjoyed this because it reminded me of the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. But it's like, maybe...
Well, you just like...
maybe you just enjoyed it. Because of a reason that you can say without referencing something else.
If you like a movie because it reminded you of another movie, then didn't you just like one movie and not two?
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like you like that first movie, and you kind of wish this movie you just saw was that movie. But it's been a long time. How many, like, art films come out anymore?
Oh, a bunch. I mean, it depends on your...
What's, like, the definition of an art film?
Yeah, because if you want to talk, like, art film in the traditional sense of, like, Persona or Seventh Seal, these movies with, you know, weird dualities in filmmaking and single frames of penises and, like, a bed floating in midair for no reason that you can read into what you want. But, like, a Tarkovsky movie, see, I just did that. I said Tarkovsky movie without explaining what I meant.
What are you trying to say?
Tarkovsky movies generally have a lot of imagery that is not explained and is completely left up to you to understand what it means, and maybe it's meaningless.
Okay.
Maybe it doesn't serve anything greater. Like, the end of his movie Nostalgia ends with one of the main characters walking back and forth with a candle in this empty pool, trying to not let it burn out, and then when he crosses it without it burning out and he sets it down, he dies. And there's... Okay. You don't know why.
Yeah.
And you're not... I'm sure there was maybe meaning to it. But that's an art film move.
Yeah.
Whereas you could talk about an art film like Swiss Army Man that's coming out or has come out already.
Well, it premiered at Sundance and now it's having a wider release.
And from what I understand, it's a very, like, narratively cohesive movie, but you could call it an art film just because it's unusual.
Yeah. Where it seems like, at least from the trailer, it seems like the overwhelming message seems to be learning to live again when you feel like all is lost.
Yeah. But you end up with these movies sometimes where if you can't read into them and you're not sure there's anything to read into them, you can just throw them aside and say, oh, it's just an art film.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to, like... I meant, like, the movies that I see being released are at least widely released, and that's probably... We're exposed to the wider release than more than anything else.
Yeah.
But it's all things that you don't really need to read into. You know, it's the action films, it's the romantics, it's even the things that win Oscars. Sometimes they're not even really art films, they're just really well-done non-fiction pieces. I will say Birdman is a good art film.
Yeah.
Because that's a film... It's filled with symbolism and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got more of, like, a very straightforward narrative. But then it still has moments that you have to read into things, and there's no clear answers.
So I think what... When people say art film, because all films are art.
It's,
you know,
true.
Even Transformers 2 is art. you know.
To some degree, technical aspects of it are great.
Yeah.
Narrative-wise, it suffers.
Also, I read the most succinct description of how to find out if something is art.
How?
If you ever ask yourself if it's art, it's art. If your brain ever asks itself that question, it's art.
So, like, sitting through Transformers 3,
mm-hmm.
you're never gonna ask yourself, is this art, so therefore it's not?
No, you'll probably think that, because you'll see how trashy it is, and you're like, is this still art? It is.
There are technical aspects that I think can be applauded, but narrative—I don't remember what the third one
was. I mean, acting's an art, cinematography's an art. It has those. It's art. It's not good art. It's a Thomas Kincaid painting. But
so, but are we not making a distinction between catch and art?
What
kitsch? Catch?
What? Kitsch. Explain yourself.
You know what kitsch is?
Kinda.
It's like pop art.
Oh, okay.
Which still has the word art in it, which can be a little confusing, but it's like mass-produced, mass-consumed things that have little actual value, according to the artists.
Still art. Still art. Art isn't sacred. Art is anything. Well, art is so many things.
That is a very non-modernist view.
But when I... Anyway, back to art films. Quickly, what I was going to say is,
okay.
Do you think that art films are like a continuum, like... The more obfuscation there is between audience to intent, the more on the art film spectrum it is. Because if you've ever seen like a really dense like Ingmar Bergman movie with a ton of symbolism that is not easily explained, that's very ethereal and weird, and you're not sure what the intent was, and maybe you'll never truly know what the intent is, that's very far on this art film scale.
Yeah.
But take like The Revenant, which had very artistic choices and was a beautiful movie. That's pretty like close to us on the art film scale. Many people would not call it an art film because it's pretty straightforward,
except for all the parts where he's remembering and how the wife and kid died or whatever.
Yeah,
but I also it is a spectrum. Of course you can't categorize everything in the same sort of set of standards because everyone makes different choices.
But I think the argument I'm making is every movie is an art film, because all films are art. It's just how far away from the audience the film feels is what we call an art film.
Yeah.
Because if a movie, let's say there's this movie by Salvador Dali, Un Chien Andalou, which is also, I think, a Pixies song took that as inspiration.
I think you're right.
But it's an intentionally meaningless movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is intentionally supposed to mean absolutely nothing.
Very postmodern of him.
Is that... I mean, that's an art movie.
Yeah.
But if it's intentionally supposed to have no meaning, where is it on that spectrum?
Well, it's...
Like far, far away or super close?
Well, then you bring in the... That's a critique of other art films.
Mm-hmm.
So it belongs with those films.
Yeah.
Because it's critiquing them. It's parodying... trying to make a statement.
Yeah.
About them.
I find it funny when people hold that film up as having meaning without understanding its history. It's like, no, it was a critique of these art films that were so obfuscated from audience understanding. They were essentially meaningless.
Yeah.
You know, it has some great shots. Cinematography is very good.
So it's,
but when someone's just playing a piano with the corpse of a cow on it, it's supposed to be completely meaningless.
Art's a spectrum.
Yeah.
It is. But, I mean, I don't know. It becomes sort of, if we consider all things art, then the conversation isn't even worth having.
I mean, I think it is. I just think that art means a lot of things.
There are people,
yes,
and schools of thought,
mm-hmm.
who have been debating the question, what is art,
mm-hmm.
versus what is not art,
mm-hmm.
forever.
Yeah.
And each school of thought has brought up its own criteria,
mm-hmm.
for what is art.
Mm-hmm.
We now live in an age where our schools of thoughts are being developed and will be studied 30 years later,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know what any of them are saying.
Yeah.
So there could be a new acceptance of art school of thought where, mm-hmm. everything is being accepted, mm-hmm. and sort of judged on this spectrum.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to be talking about the Transformers series in 30 years.
Oh no, they won't be.
So that would be a sort of point against it to consider it not art. Because art seems to be lasting.
Yeah. I mean, it's all a question of, like, whether art is, like, meaningful and who it's meaningful to. And I think the thing about any conversation, any, like, what's the word? Like, epistemological
Okay.
Whatever.
Any
big meaningful conversation about art is essentially, what's it mean? What's it mean something to? Who matters in the conversation? Is this aimed at someone? Does it matter if it's aimed at someone? Does an audience matter?
Yeah.
You know, if we're talking about, like, let's talk about, like, frescoes, right?
Okay.
We hold frescoes up as big, lasting, meaningful pieces of art.
Yeah.
If someone discovered a really shitty fresco, would we talk about it?
Probably not, unless it was done on purpose to make fun of frescoes.
True.
Or to critique them, as they call it.
But does something enter, like, the lexicon of art? Is there, like, an inflection point where if we go back to the 40s, we only have a certain few films, books, things like that, that we hold up as, like, these are meaningful.
Yeah.
30,000 years from now, if someone digs up a copy of a real stinker of a movie from the 40s, it's meaningful, it's lasting, does it become art then?
Well, see, that's the thing. If they have to dig it up, how do you mean? Do you mean, like, it's in an archive? It was saved
on purpose? No, like, if it's discovered, and it's something that they are so far removed from that time that they cannot view from...
It'll be trash.
Will it?
Yeah.
I mean, if we found something that we never knew existed and we were able to view it, would we hold it up as art?
It depends. Can we put it in context?
I mean, like the frescoes that survived today, were those the best frescoes? Not necessarily. They're just the ones we found.
I mean, another thing you could say is, like, because I'm not as familiar with frescoes as maybe you could say, like, a Picasso.
Yeah.
In 200 years, say, art history is kind of wiped out. Nobody knows what art is. You find a Picasso, and a late period Picasso, when he's doing his cubism and all the abstraction that he's doing, you find that cold.
Yeah, no context.
No context. You look at it, you're going to be like, this is a shitty painting.
Yeah.
So then, therefore...
Does that invalidate previous Picassos?
Well, in this context where we've lost the context for Picasso, then yeah. Because art is a lot of context. Look at Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
He was like the first screen printer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like, there are t-shirts that screen print.
Yeah.
Does that invalidate his work, or does the fact of the context that we know he was the first still validate him? And that's a mixed bag of discussion, because there's even, you know, people in the art community who don't think that Andy Warhol was an artist.
But even these pretty limited discussions we're having of, like, you know, context-free, like, in the future science fiction world, what's art?
Yeah.
There are hundreds of thousands of conversations to be had within that conversation. I think it's essentially impossible to know definitely what art is.
And
it's really hard.
I think that's where we should leave it with the official zero credit stamp.
The official zero credit stamp of, we don't know.
And we shouldn't know.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you start limiting what is art and what is not, then you start doing value judgments against people who like certain things.
Yep.
So everyone who likes a Transformers movie, you're good people. Because you still find value in things.
Yeah.
As long as there's value to be found by someone somewhere, everything's good.
As long as you have an interest in something, who cares?
The only thing that's not art...
Yes.
Is The Last Airbender by M. Night Shyamalan.
It's the only movie that isn't art.
That is not art. I don't know what it is.
I really thought you were going to... Let's not talk about it.
What?
But I thought you were going to look me dead in the eyes and go, nature. And we'd have this whole, like, nature versus art debate.
I think we...
Let's not have that debate.
I think we already agreed that nature is art in a previous...
Okay, good.
...thing, because...
As long as we're on the same page.
I was arguing something, yeah. It was discussed in a previous episode.
Okay, sweet. Yeah, I have no idea what we were talking about before we started talking about the nature of art.
We were talking about The Silver Screen Fiend.
Oh!
By Patton Oswalt.
So, Patton Oswalt, if you listen to this podcast, which you do not, it's good that you know that your book made us talk about the nature of art for entirely too long. It's a good book, you should read it. Really easy, breezy, almost stream of consciousness read.
That's great.
And you should be wary with how you communicate with people and don't judge them if they haven't had the same experiences as you.
Seriously, don't.
And, man, I think that might just about...
It might.
It might just about bring us to the end of this podcast.
Oh, there's not another side to this. What did you watch?
Oh, what did you watch?
Did we go over time with the what did you watch?
We can make it work.
We can make it work with the what did you watch.
You said you didn't watch anything.
I didn't. but we weren't going to bring it up on the show. We're going to let the viewers know that I've been busy, and so I haven't had time to watch anything.
What'd you watch?
Oh, okay, I've been busy.
Yes.
And so I haven't really had time to watch anything. I've been driving all over the state, and I'm even leaving today to drive to a different state.
Nice.
I watched The Graduation.
Nice.
You know, what's bad about graduations?
What's up?
All of it.
Yep.
They're self-serving, just horrible things that take way too long. And I'm glad I went because I clapped along to the people I knew. And like, man, yay, they graduated.
Mm-hmm.
Could have just sent them a text.
Yep.
I did send you a text.
You did. My graduation was essentially me sitting there being like, what a big pointless pageant this all is.
It's pageantry.
Yep.
And also, man, if you're going to get a commencement speaker, just bring in somebody from outside the school. Don't let a student do it.
Don't bring like a 21-year-old up there.
Don't let a student who's basically just going to give a valedictorian speech, which is to say, man, guys, we did it. Thanks for the support. Let's go get them.
Let's go get them at this football game that none of you will care about once you graduate.
It really felt like, man, that kid has no idea what's in store for him. And probably, with all his connections, it won't matter.
Yep.
But still.
I really, just get the most famous person you can. It doesn't even matter if they're a good speaker. Just end up on YouTube with it. Who cares?
At least you didn't have the governor.
Ugh.
I had the governor at one of my graduations.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's awful.
It was bad.
What a piece of shit he is.
It was. His main message was like, stay in the state.
Yep. Don't leave, please. We're dying. Yep.
I don't want to linger on that. I just be included because, man.
I'm glad. Half of the podcast. It's the graduation time, and I'm glad you brought it up.
Yay!
And if you can walk for your graduation, do it once. Don't do it a second time.
Unless your parents force you to.
Yay! Also, unless your parents force you to, don't even do it once if you don't want to. Just do whatever.
Do whatever you want. I knew people who got their doctorate this semester, and they didn't even get hooded. They just...
Yeah.
They skipped it, and it's like, you know what? Good for you.
I had a bunch of cords and stuff I could buy and put on mine. I'm like, it's just going to be garbage that I put in a box afterwards.
It's a box of memories,
It's a waste
Sean.
Of money.
A box of memories.
I got a coin out of it.
You get a coin?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't get a coin.
Yeah.
All right.
All right.
So let's turn our attention to Social Media Corner.
Yay. Can I start?
Sure. Social Media Corner. Let's go.
Oh, actually someone sent us something.
Yeah.
Someone DM'd us on Twitter.
Elric's cousin.
Elric's cousin.
There's an L there.
Wait, no, we already gave this person a name.
I know, but...
So Eric.
Eric.
So Eric.
Eric sent us, pointed out to us the fact that...
There's a new Over the Garden Wall comic.
And so we gotta check that out.
And talk about it to you next time. Because you know how much we love OTGW.
I don't know if it's going to be quite next time.
Maybe next-ish time.
Yeah, it'll be some point in the future that we might check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's been a really long time since we've had a supplemental reading.
Yeah. We need to get drunk and talk about something again.
We need to both experience the same thing, get drunk and talk about it.
Have you seen Civil War yet?
No.
You should.
I'm gonna try soon.
Do it.
Oh, all right, we'll do that.
So you know how that person got in contact with us over Twitter? They tweeted at us at ZCPCWHJ. Stands for Zero Credits Podcast with Henry John.
Yep, just get in contact with us at ZCPCWHJ, and hey, you can be on the podcast, just like Eric.
Just like Eric. And if you want to be not like Eric, you can send us an email.
Oh, I haven't checked that recently.
At zerocreditsisapodcast@gmail.com.
And we could turn it into a segment.
We'll do it. If we check it.
Also, you can send us corrections there.
Ooh, please correct us.
We just had a big, long discussion about art.
Tell us what art is. I fucking dare you.
Here's some homework, listeners. Email us at zerocreditsisapodcast@gmail.com with your answer to the question, what is art?
And you know, if you can't do any of that, just like, comment, and subscribe on our iTunes, SoundCloud, Mixlr, Zorp. That's a service. Zorp.
Alternatively, you can find us on Blogger.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all that really is just, you know, the video descriptions and a link to the podcast.
And follow me on Gaia Online and follow Henry's Zanga.
If you can find it.
Don't do it.
Yep. Please don't. All right.
All right. Let's get on out of here.
Roll them up.
Roll.
Tide.
Nope. Had them on. Roll them up. Roll them up. Had them on. Had them on. Roll. Ride.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
Say goodbye, John.
Goodbye.
John.
That podcast deserves an applause.
Bucked, 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 bucked.